session number 27460, reel 19.
Mr. Willock's reel 19. You're now then in the Kohima area.
Yes, our guns were sighted on Kohima, and the rains had started. I know we went 10 days without the rain ever easing up, day and night, and we had to be extra cautious at night to listen because there was so much noise from falling rain, dripping leaves and the likes. So you didn't know what was happening. And I was always concerned for my vehicles that were unguarded that had to be left out on the roadside. The track in was very dangerous, and it was while we were in this position that I'd been stung with something, and I had blood poisoning in my arm, which had created a lump as big as a golf ball under my left armpit. When the MO came up, he'd been treating me for a day or two. By now I had to have my arm in a sling, but I was still carrying on. I wouldn't give in. And this day he said, the MO said to me, he said, "Well," he said, "if it's no better tomorrow, I'll have to open it." And tomorrow came, and he did open it. In a rather crude way, his vehicle came onto the position, and standing there in the pouring rain with a monsoon cape on, I had my arm out of the cape, and I just had to hold the superstructure at the back of his truck, and he inserted the knife into my arm and gave it a twist, and he kept asking me if I was all right, so did his orderly, and I kept lyingly said yes, and I... Eventually, I just about passed out. I collapsed, and I had to... They put my head up onto the embankment a bit, and someone brought me a rum from the officer's mess. And I was just a put what relief. It discharged for about 4 days, and then I was okay again.
So a pretty crude medical situation you were in, really, weren't it?
Yes.
Everything done on the spot, you might say.
That's right. And as the MO said, he had to twist the knife to make sure that the wound wouldn't heal quickly, so that the discharge would come out, and mind it did.
But you still kept on doing
it. Oh yes, I would not give in.
So can we get the picture then? Your guns are dug into the hillside, are they?
Yes, they're dug in, and our gun crews were being depleted with disease and everything else, and the CCRA had ordered that Wellingtons would be issued to all the gun crews. Of course, the gun pits were flooded all the time. And we did get some chaps that were new out from England came and joined us this day. And our gun sergeants were trying to teach some of these people our gun drill. And at around about 5 o'clock, there came a request from the observation post that there were some elephants pulling Japanese heavy guns up to the position, up towards Kohima over the mountains, and we were called upon to destroy them. And our guns went into action. Now, one of the guns was manned by a personal friend of mine, Sergeant Verse, a Welsh lad, and the blessed gun blew up, killing two of the chaps that had just come out from England, and another man. There were three killed and seven wounded. Sergeant Verse was blinded and deafened, but he did regain his sight, but he never regained his hearing.
What caused that?
Well, we used to refer to them as prematures, the shell exploding in the barrel. We'd had quite a few. This was a premature number 6. The first one, the only casualty, the end of the barrel went like a banana, peeled in 5 places and just peeled back. And what the artificers used to do was to cut the barrel end off, and they could be used for bunker shooting until we got new barrels to replace them. But That first premature, the only casualty was one of the gunners had about a quarter of an inch skimmed off the top of his ear. And that was it. Now, this one was a nasty one, and it wasn't to be the last.
Was this due to bad manufacture of the shell? Or?
Well, there were various statements made about it. Sometimes the fuses were blamed. Sometimes, in fact, all the guns, because they thought it was the manufacturer, every gun was issued with I can't think of the name of them. To measure the.
These measuring.
That's right. Yes. The name's gone, and they were locked in that position at 5.5 inches, so that they were exact. And they used to be run over when the shell was being prepared from the stack. The gunner would check the size of the shell before fitting the fuse.
But of course, you still had them from time to time, as you were saying.
Yes.
But it made the gun crews rather nervous every time they rammed a shell in. And
yes. Later on, an order came out that the guns had only to be fired with a 30-foot lanyard and fired from a slit trench. But I think later, like when I'm referring to the time of the battles of the Irrawaddy, the guns were firing day and night, and the gunners were exhausted. They hadn't the strength to run back to the slit trench. They were just loading them, firing, and that was that.
You were still corps artillery, were you?
Oh, yes, always. 5.5s always are corps artillery. The 25-pounders stay with the divisions.
Do you know which corps you were attached to or part of?
We were 33rd Corps.
And the division, or the divisions?
Well, we, as corps, we supported various divisions, and at Kohima we were supporting the 2nd British Division.
Had you any idea what was going on at Kohima when you arrived?
We knew it was encircled, besieged, and we knew that things were very difficult for them in the town, and it was up to us to try and do all we could. And I think everyone did, uncomplaining.
So the Japanese were extremely close to the British troops involved. How accurate was your shell fire to remove them from that position? Or could you get that close?
Our shell fire was very accurate. I've heard it from two different sources. From one person who was actually in Kohima, and he referred to the accuracy of the guns, and how we always managed to deliver.
Well, you dug in, and you're, as you say, you're supporting the regimental guns of the division.
That's right.
Firing on Kohima. Were you? Did you have any officer who was forward observing fall of shot, or did that come?
They were battery officers that went forward, yes.
And they, as I say, they were in communication with the batteries.
Yes, and I think I understood that our forward observation officer, Captain Booth Jones, had been killed, but I couldn't trace that later.
What was happening to yourself in this position?
Well, I think we were getting a bit impatient. We were wanting to move on, and I know that things had started moving. One day when I went off the gun, off the headquarters position, I went out to inspect my vehicles, as I did every day while we were there, and I saw the CCRA standing with his back to a big rock. And as I was walking out, I could smell the ominous signs of a burning clutch. And I thought, now what's going on? And when I got out onto the road, there was the CCRA. Now, when we were in South India, he'd come to visit our regiment on a few occasions, and on one occasion, when he'd come, his vehicle wasn't running very well. And so our colonel of the day had suggested I had a look at it for him. and it seemed as though he used to plan his visits when his car needed a tune-up. So, on this occasion, when I walked out, he spied me, and I think he possibly recognised me. And he just pointed to this vehicle that was stuck, and he said, "Shift that bloody truck!" And it was a line of communication vehicle with five or six mules in the back. There was nothing covering them, just the superstructure with ropes round and round it to keep them in. Now, officially, no one was supposed to push these Indian drivers out, and you weren't allowed to take over. But the CCRA overcame this. Now, normally they had two drivers. This one just fortunately had one. So I would push my way in from the driver's side, which meant getting round the spare wheel and into the deep seats, which had low armrests on them for safety. And the CCRA encouraged him with a few bits of urdu and got him into the passenger seat. And I got the vehicle and I put it into first gear, to which this Indian raised his hands and said, "No gear, Saab, no gear, no gear." Oh, I thought, that's all I want. And so anyway, I thought I'll chance it. And I just gently let the clutch in and the vehicle took off, no trouble. And these fellows were trained on the planes to start off in second gear, and I think they thought they always had to. So I pulled out the hand throttle a little bit, and I got onto the running board and let the driver get into the driver's seat, and then I jumped off. And this Indian, "Tikai, Tikai, Tikai, Saab, Tikai." That was me. He was away. And the CCRA had wanted that vehicle moved because the tanks were coming up. And I think they were coming up to give a bit more support at Kohima.
From the point of view of getting your supplies, you could bring them up by road. You weren't under the mule situation.
Oh, no. All our supplies at this stage were coming up.
So you were beside the road.
Yes.
Did you know as each day what things were what was happening at Kohima?
Each night our adjutant would give us an appraisal of what had happened and what the situation was.
And 2nd Division was in there, so the Durham Light Infantry were in there.
That's right, yes.
At that time.
I think it was the 8th. Was it the 8th Durhams?
The 2nd.
2nd Durhams.
Yeah, yeah. And that would be towards the end of the siege, really. They were there.
That's right, they came up.
What else do you recall of that you were doing, or what was happening to you in that position?
I remember a convoy of ambulances coming up when the relief of Kohima was imminent, and then we got impatient because it didn't happen as quickly as we wanted. But then the ambulances did eventually start to roll, and we then had to move up. But before we did, the survey sergeant asked me to take him up. He could ride a motorbike, but he had things to carry, and we had to go to a place in Kohima, in the churchyard, and we thought it would be difficult to get a vehicle up. A motorbike would get through much easier, and if he had someone to ride it for him, he wouldn't have to worry about parking it or anything else. And so we went up, and he had to find a twig that had been left in the churchyard. I think it was a churchyard, if my memory serves me right. I'm pretty certain it was. Anyway, it was something left by another artillery regiment as a focal point from which we could set our guns. And sure enough, we got into the churchyard, and there it was. He found the twig. Well, hundreds and hundreds of bits of broken tree and broken. He found what he was looking, but he knew roughly where to look. So,
how could he distinguish a twig from all the rest of the tree stuff lying around?
Because it had been stuck.
Must have been lots of twigs, I would have thought.
There were, but that one had been stuck in the ground.
In a certain position.
That's right. So he knew once he got there. And at the side of the road, there were some Gurkhas changing a bogey wheel on a Brendon carrier. And as we stood beside where they were, we watched an infantry attack going in down the hillside. And it was very worrying. We could see the Japanese guns on the other hill spurting fire. We could see our own men making their way down through the thick jungle growth, and we could see them fall, and we could hear the shouts for stretcher bearers and that. Oh, it wasn't pleasant.
What was the view that you were getting? Not out under the, but the view of the position that had been under this constant fighting for so long. What was the position?
Oh, it looked like a World War I Battle of the Somme. Terrible. And there were still some dead to bury. I know I picked up two Japanese pay books and a letter lying near some dead Japs.
And this was the letter that you
yes.
Read out on television?
That's right.
And it was from, what was it, who was it from?
We think it was from the mother of one of these Japs.
And I do recall that it was like a letter to any mother to a son.
That's right, mm-hmm. Yes. And you see, when that letter had been written, the Japanese hadn't had a defeat. And there she's praising them for all they've done, knowing things would be bad for them, but to keep going.
You mentioned that there were still dead around. Were they British dead that you were looking at?
I didn't see any British dead, no. I think, in all honesty, I think those would be taken care of first. Japanese would be left out so they could be searched for anything of interest.
So you were on top of the hill, which had been cleared by then, presumably, and
yes.
The attack was going farther on, as you said.
Down the valley, onto another hill. Kohima is just a mass of hills.
And you must have felt it for the infantry, did you?
Oh, definitely, yes. Well, I've always said they were the ones that fought the battle. We only supported them.
By this time, you'd been in Burma for quite a while, and this was the Forgotten Army, as it was called
yes.
in those days. Did you have feelings that did it percolate right down to the ranks?
At that stage, we hadn't got that feeling we were forgotten, because we hadn't been... Kohima was in northeast India still, and we were still... in the throes of advancing and pushing forward, and we felt that we were getting so we were getting equipment. So at that stage we didn't feel so forgotten, or the chaps that I was with didn't feel too bad, but we often heard it referred to. But we actually moved into Kohima ourselves, the regimental headquarters and the battery that had come up with us from the Arakan, and when we moved into Kohima, as we drove round into Kohima, there were Japanese on the other hillside. We could see them frantically digging in, and there was a heavy machine gun company giving us cover as we drove into round the escarpment into Kohima.
You mentioned just the one battery was with you at that point.
Yes, then. We'd left one battery down on the Arakan.
What battery was it that was with you?
522.
Which seems to be the one you were with most of the time, hasn't it?
Well, it had been Major Soames's battery at one time, prior to him being made second in command, which was shortly before we moved into Burma. And, of course, a second in command, he immediately took command.
And you're taking your positions with the battery in the village, or what was left of it,
of Kohima. Yes.
And the fighting wasn't that far away, really.
Oh, no.
Did you feel it was a bit of a hairy situation?
A little bit. When we knew they were as close, when we'd seen them just on the other hillside.
Had you had any casualties within your own regimental headquarters and battery headquarters?
Not in regimental headquarters, no. Up to now we were still okay. But the battery had suffered because they had three men killed on the Arakan.
Were they taking wounded men down as you moved in?
Well, all the ambulances had gone and were now coming back for more.
So it was a constant stream of...
Yes. I think the worst casualties had been evacuated, and then the less...
So what happened to you then after you took a position in Kohima?
We were very lucky because we got a hot bath and some dry underwear, but that was a lost cause because we had to put wet battle dress on top of it.
Still heavy rain.
Oh, torrential. Where we got our baths, I should say, they had laid a big tarpaulin sheet on the ground. It was on a bit of sloping ground. It was a sheet 40 feet by 40 feet, and they rigged another one above it, 40 feet by 40 feet. So you went under there, and what they had was 40-gallon oil or petrol barrels, halved vertically, and opened out like two half tubs. And we drew our ration of hot water, and these were placed end to end on the tarpaulin sheet. And you just got a bath and enjoyed the luxury of the hot water, and then put on your dry underwear, which insulated you from the wet battle dress for a while. And of course, the monsoon cape was as wet on the inside as it was on the out. It was a gabardine, which was better than oilskin, but it was still uncomfortable.
And this was a cape, you say?
A cape, yes.
With sleeves, didn't you?
No sleeves, just slits. Your arms came out of the slits.
And how far down the body did they go?
Oh, just below the knee, I would say.
Sleeping situation when you're in those positions, where were you sleeping?
Well, before we moved up into Kohima, we'd managed to rig a bit of cover, part of a tent, and bits of corrugated sheet, whatever we could find.
And sleeping on the ground?
Yes. One or two chaps had managed to get hold of old broken stretchers, but at that Kohima position, it was sleeping on the ground on ground sheets. And we had gas capes, which was an oilskin cape, and that used to help to cover you.
So you improvised, in a sense?
Improvised, yes, all the time.
And wet most of the time, presumably?
You just lived wet, yes.
Did that affect your health? I mean, you had your own little problems, but in terms of the whole unit, did you retain your health?
Well, I managed to, yes, right to the bitter end.
You mentioned that Lord Mountbatten had come to you earlier. Did you ever come across any of the other hierarchy?
Later on, yes.
So we can do that later on when we got to it.
That's right.
Mail, how often was that coming to you?
Mail was still a bit slow. Airmail, when we were in India, we used to say 10 days, and I think it might be about 12, 14 days when we were up at Kohima. But in all fairness, the only address we were allowed to use was 1st Medium Regiment SEAC, which was Southeast Asia Command. So all the troops that were out there, that mail was to sort. To find out at first medium, and then the batteries did put their battery on, and it was, one was 1-3 battery, the other was 5-2-2 first medium regiment. So mail could be sorted. It did improve though later on.
Presumably you get a bunch of letters probably at
your
time.
Yes. Because, invariably it used to get a bunch together and...
And yours would be censored, presumably.
I never, in all honesty, saw any of my incoming mail that had been censored. Possibly had been.
But your own going out.
Oh, yes. My own going out went out. Within the regiment, we used to get what was called a green envelope. And you could write a letter to someone, put it in that envelope, and it would not be censored by the regiment, but it would be censored further back down the line. But anything and everything I ever had also was never destroyed.
And you were married, so you're getting your letters from your wife.
Yes.
And how important was mail to a soldier?
Very. And the trouble was that by now, I mean, we'd been abroad for a while, and there were quite a number of cases of wives going off with somebody else. There were also lots of engagements broken and things like that. But
did you see the effects of that upon any person to your own knowledge?
Yes. It was just a bit further up the road where I had the first case, and later on with the second case, where I personally I talked in both cases to the person. And bear in mind, I was just a youngster to the others. And there I was, sort of giving philosophical advice, which worked out in both cases.
There must have been a desperate situation for a man who was so far away and couldn't get back home. Or
that's right. Well, the one man, they were Salvationists, Salvation Army, and his wife had gone off with somebody else. And my reasoning to him was that he hadn't actually played the game himself. So I said, now, curb it a bit and just think. Put yourself in Gilligan's place and think. And I said, see if you can make it up. It would be far better if you come to terms with it, because a broken marriage is a terrible thing, especially with a family. And they did. And years later, I met him at one of our regimental reunions and said everything was fine. The other man, he'd had a lot of bad luck. He was a regular soldier, and he'd married a girl from Aberdeen. They had a house down in Portsmouth, and they were living there when the war broke out. And he thought, well, she'd far better be back with her own folk up in Aberdeen. And so he would check up to see how cheaply they could get their furniture and everything taken up. And by sending it by sea was a cheaper way. So it didn't get out of the Thames and was sunk. So that was the furniture gone for him. Well, she'd gone up home, and she was with her parents, and she'd got on with a naval officer, and she was having a child to him. And she had to, and I remember this fellow, his name was Valor, and Gossage was his friend, actually. And Gossage came to me this day, and he said, I don't know what's up with Valor. He said, he's right in the dumps. And I was in charge of the post, so I thought, well, I'll have to put my boot behind Valor to get him to do something, to pull his weight. I did, and I managed to get it out of him what had happened. And I gave him the same advice I'd given to Beeching. I said, you've not been playing the game. I said, no, consider it. I said, consider her. Just think of the torment. She's had to confess what's happened, and to her parents. I said, see if you can make it up. See if you... So I said, have a word with the padre. And but by this time we had a different party, but he did manage to do some good. And just before we came home, this Valor was flown out to go home on compassionate leave, and Gossage got a letter to say that they were fine. Valor was adopting the little girl that this officer had fathered, and they would be okay.